Well, thank you so much for that introduction. This has been a really fun session thus far because we are working on topics that are so related, and I already have learned quite a bit from the other papers presented. So as I go through, I'll try and maybe tie together some themes that will help to lead us into a productive Q&A session. As I mentioned, this is co-authored work with my friend and colleague, Candace Kapanos. She's at RAND Corporation. We don't have anything to disclose. So, as many of us in this room know all too well, colorectal cancer is the third leading cause of cancer death in the U.S. It's behind breast for women, prostate for men, and lung. Now, the good news is, if we catch it early, the survival rate is 90% when it's caught at stage one. However, as others alluded to earlier, only about 40% of cancers are caught at that stage. Now, why might that be? Well, only about 42% of women and 44% of men actually receive the screening that they are recommended to receive. So really the point of this research for us is to figure out why, and not only just why the population in general does not receive the recommended screening, but in this paper we're particularly focused on some of the disparities. So underlying those 42 and 44% figures, there are substantial differences by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. Now, previous work has really focused a lot on these differences by socioeconomic status and pointed out that when we look at these disparities and we adjust for differences in socioeconomic status, we explain a huge proportion of the observed disparity. And in some cases in those regression models, when we add household income and education to the model, that race or ethnicity term is no longer statistically significant. So again, that suggests that we're explaining a large proportion using those household income or education measures. But what bothered Candace and I about this is we thought, you know, first of all, this is a little bit dismal for policy because that means we're looking really at some tough issues of confronting inequality. But also, we wanted to think about, is it really, in fact, the income that we think is operating here? Is it really individual socioeconomic status? Or is it possible in some of these big data approaches that maybe we're picking up underlying health plan fragmentation? So through the 2002 Institutes of Medicine report that really focused on this issue of health plan fragmentation for disparities researchers. And the definition is health plan fragmentation is differences in the amounts and quality of the health care consumed that may arise because of systematic differences in plan benefits and cost sharing. So intuitively, in our models, if we're just controlling for income, but we don't know anything about cost sharing under the plans or the benefits provided under the plans, and that's correlated with an individual's income, well then we might see that income looks really, really important according to our models, when in fact this is what's going on behind the scenes. And it's really reasonable to expect that those who are low income but still insured, they probably don't have the same kind of plans as those who are high income and insured. So that all sounds fairly convincing, but the trouble is, how do we study this? The data that we have do not contain measures of the generosity in insurance coverage, especially not with respect to a given condition or screening. So, absent that, what do we do? Well, we might look for a natural experiment. And this is what we do in this work, and previous studies have done this as well. There are a couple recent ones that we might exploit. For example, there was an expansion in coverage under Medicare in 2001 for endoscopic screenings. And there were also several state mandates that occurred from about 1999 on through 2011. Those are the focus of this paper, and previous studies have looked at these a bit as well. What previous studies found is after that Medicare expansion, we did in fact see the black-white disparity eliminated. However, at the same time, they also found that the Hispanic, non-Hispanic disparity grew. Other studies that have looked at these state mandates, they found in the population as a whole, we did see screening increase after the mandates passed, but when they tried to look at this for disparities, they didn't find any evidence of a change in disparities under mandated coverage. So we're going back and looking at this issue again with a slightly different empirical approach, because in previous work of our own, when we looked at this overall population effect using our approach, we actually found effect sizes that were much bigger than 1.4 percentage points. On average, around 2 to 3 percentage points, and in some cases, some models as large as 5 to 7 percentage points. So we figure if our results are differing for the overall population, perhaps there's reason to go back and reconsider this issue of disparities as well. So the goal of our paper first is to look at disparities in a very specific population. We want to look at individuals 50 to 64 who are insured. So these are folks who are not yet Medicare eligible, but they do have health insurance, and we want to confirm, are we finding that income is actually important in this group as well? Or is it perhaps something else that may be going on for this group? And then, of course, we want to directly look at the impact of mandated coverage on the disparities that we observe in this population. So this is the population that we would expect those mandates to affect. Of course, you have to have health insurance for the law to apply to you, and the law specifically applies to privately insured plans. Now, the data we're going to use for this come from the BRFIS. We're using years 2002, 4, 6, and 8. Those are the years in which the screening questions are fielded, and we're purposely excluding years prior to that 2001 Medicare expansion because we are going to include those Medicare folks in our model as a control group, which I'll explain in just a moment. Again, our focus is on insured individuals, and our treatment population are those folks ages 50 to 64. Now, as mentioned earlier, there are two potential avenues for colorectal cancer screening, many possible tests, but you can sort of categorize them into these two groups. There's the endoscopic test, and there are the blood stool test methods. They vary substantially with respect to cost. The endoscopic methods, and colonoscopy in particular, are very expensive. So we would expect, perhaps, that mandates would lead more people to be able to afford these more expensive methods. So it's possible we might even see some shifting across modes. The outcome measures that we consider first are just whether or not people are up to date with current screening recommendations. But then because of these differences in cost and also the differences in sensitivity and specificity of the test, we look at these two categories of screening tests separately as well. Now, the race and ethnicity measures that we use are fairly blunt. We're only able to look at things for white, black, Asian, Pacific Islander, and Native American and Alaskan Native, those groups together, because as you'll see, we're even pushing our statistical power quite substantially just to be able to look at these groupings. Obviously, we think that there are some important things going on within those groups, but at this point, that's what the data will allow. We also consider Hispanic ethnicity, but we do that separately so that anyone in our four racial groups could also be coded as Hispanic or non-Hispanic. So those are two separate dimensions in our analysis. Now, as I mentioned earlier, state mandates were passed between 1999 and 2011. And overall, 34 states and DC have mandates in place currently. 18 of these are enacted during our study period. But in what I show you today, we're using data from all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Okay, other covariates that we try to account for in our model, first of all, we try to get at some of these community-level factors that previous papers have mentioned may be important. And this is something kind of unique. Normally, when you use the BRFIS data, you don't have good information at the county level. And so what we've tried to do is merge in information about the percentage of the county that's in poverty, designation as a health professional shortage area, proportion of the county that's rural, and also state-level health management organization penetration. Now, in our analysis of mandates, that actually ends up being perfectly collinear with some of the fixed effects that we include in that model, so that falls out. But in a sense, intuitively, it's still controlled for there as well. The trade-off to doing this, of course, though, is when we merge these things in, we can only do so for counties that we have identifiers for, and so we are systematically excluding some of these smaller counties from our analysis. Our measures of socioeconomic status are education, income, and I'm kind of lumping in marital status and having a regular doctor there as well. These are all included separately in the model. Our health measures that we control for are self-reported health status, whether or not the person has ever smoked, if they are obese or diabetic, and those are all used in previous studies. We've also included a measure of mortality, but we're pulling from deaths between 1990 and 1999 to do that, so we're using a lagged measure. And the reason is the relationship between current screening and current mortality rates is kind of complex, right? Current screening should be having an impact, we hope, on current mortality rates. So we want to try and avoid some of that dual causation, and we're using that lagged mortality measure. Now, for the decomposition, the method that we're using is the Fairley method for nonlinear models, and that's because we're looking at screening outcomes that are binary. Are you screened? Are you not screened? For those of you familiar with an Oaxaca decomposition, this is just the method for nonlinear models. Intuitively, all we're trying to do there is say how much of the disparity that we see is explained by the levels of our covariates. So the fact that one group makes more money than another, the fact that one group is more educated than another, or lives in a poorer county than another. That's the goal of a basic decomposition. Now, the mandate analysis, we're using a triple difference, or difference in difference in differences method. So some of you may be quite familiar, I would guess, with difference in differences methodology. I'm going to show you the rationale for adding an additional group. But briefly, our groups are mandate state versus non-mandate state is our first difference, and then pre and post-mandate. Those, number one and number two together, make up your basic DD paper. To that, we layer on then a within-state control group, as I mentioned earlier, of the Medicare-eligible population, those aged 66 to 75. I'm tossing out those who are aged 65 at the time of the survey, because over that reference year, they may have been covered for a while by Medicare, may for a while then by private insurance, so we toss them out since we're not sure which group they should go into. Now, just a very quick refresher on basic DD methodology, so you have this in your head to think about the triple difference model. If we were to just look in a mandate state on its own, we would be looking at before the mandate and after the mandate, and we might conclude, hey, there's an increase in screening rates. But if there's something going on nationally where screening rates were trending, then we would have attributed that trend to the policy down here, whereas in other states that did not have a mandate, they had an increase as well. So the goal of that difference in differences estimator is, say, let's difference out this trend that was occurring nationally from what we saw in our mandate states. Now, when we add on our additional control group, it's very, very similar. What if something was going on in the mandate states only at the time of the law? If I were to just run a basic difference in differences model, I would miss that. What sorts of things might be going on at the same time as the law? Well, maybe it gets people talking. Maybe there are more informational campaigns, articles in the newspaper. Maybe that creates the impetus for more public health programs to begin in those states. And while those are very, very good things, and we do think that those have a big impact, I don't want to mistakenly attribute the impact of those things to my law, to insurance coverage. And so those things should also be affecting our Medicare population as well as our privately insured population, and that's why the control group. I'm trying to difference out the effects of these other things that may be going on. So what do we find? First of all, for the decomposition, we do find evidence of disparities in this population as well for everyone except for blacks. We actually find that blacks are more likely to be screened than whites in this population, but only slightly so, about 2 percentage point higher screening rate. And if you think about the differential mortality, we should hope that the black population would be screened more frequently than whites. They have a higher risk of colorectal cancer. But despite finding that there's no screening disparity in this population, we still see the same things explaining rates for blacks as well as our other groups. Individual income and education are the strongest predictors of our disparities. So this suggests, again, we may have the same puzzle in this population. We want to know, is the fact that we find income so important really because of income, or might it be that underlying difference in insurance? Just to note as well, we actually find that our covariates explain nearly all of the disparity for our Hispanic and our Native American groups. So we do have a good idea of some of the factors that may be going on, but what we want to know is, are our measures really telling us the truth? Is there something underlying the measures that we're using? So here are our results for the mandate analysis. I'm going to show you several graphs here. On the y-axis, I have the change in screening rates. If you wanted to convert that to a percentage, this would be a 5 percentage point increase in screening rates. So if mandates work the way I think they should, in terms of creating new opportunities for screening affordability for individuals, I should see that all of my estimates would be positive. And here you can see that I see that, but you can also see how wide my 95% confidence intervals are. So I don't find a lot conclusive for an increase in up-to-date screening rates for men. But if I look just at the screening mode where we think it should matter most, endoscopic screening, here I find something interesting. I see an increase among Hispanic males that's quite large. That's about a 10 percentage point increase in screening rates. Remember I told you baseline screening in the overall population is around 40%. In this population, it's closer to 50% because we're looking at the insured population, but still, a 10 percentage point increase is huge. Now, more importantly, when I look at my non-Hispanic change, they increased as well, but the difference is 7 percentage points. They increased by only about 3 percentage points, and this difference is strongly statistically significant. So the punchline, we do see a reduction in endoscopic screening disparities for Hispanic males. Now here when I look at blood stool test methods, I have several positive statistically significant estimates that are either bigger or kind of close to the estimate for whites, but none of these are statistically significantly different. So it looks like there were improvements in BST testing, but not more so for our minority populations than what we saw for our white population. For women, the story is a little different. We don't see any statistically significant changes in up-to-date screening. Here for endoscopic, it looks like we don't have any that are individually statistically significant, but I want to draw your eye to what's going on for Hispanic women. This is kind of bizarre. We don't see an increase for our Hispanic women. And moreover, the difference between what we see happen for Hispanic women and the increase we see for non-Hispanic women is statistically significant. So this implies why we saw a reduction in disparity for Hispanic men, we saw an increase for Hispanic women. Blood stool tests, again, for women, we don't have any statistically significant results. And this is kind of surprising that this was tougher to figure out for women because we actually have more observations, about 80,000 more, on women in the BRFAS than what we do for men. So I think in general, this kind of underscores the issue that we do need to look at these things separately by gender. We find some very different things when we look at men and women separately. Now, remember I mentioned part of what we're thinking about is, might this be operating through the effect of income? And so in the next thing that I'm going to show you, what we're looking at is pooling all races together, but saying, do mandates have an effect at the lower end of the income distribution, which would be consistent with my hypothesis that income is proxying for health plan fragmentation. And that's in fact what we find. So when we look at changes in endoscopic screening among men, we see positive estimates right here in some of these lower household income bins. We don't see it for the lowest of the low, which is perhaps a little bit puzzling, but I would guess that perhaps there are more community screening programs, perhaps for free and reduced price screening for that population, or perhaps this is a case in where in the BRFAS we're not necessarily capturing that population very well. We see the same pattern for women. The only place where we see a statistically significant change in endoscopic screening is at the lower end of the distribution. What's interesting then is we don't see the same pattern for the cheaper method of screening. Changes are flatter across the income distribution for BST for men, and in fact they hover right around zero for women. So this also sort of operates in the way we think a mandate should. It makes the more expensive screening more affordable at the lower end of the income distribution. So in total, we do find that socioeconomic status matters in this population too, the insured population. And we do have some evidence that expanding coverage may help. We see a reduction in disparity for the Hispanic male population, but an increase for the Hispanic female. But overall, we want to emphasize that we do in fact find an increase in endoscopic screening for persons at the lower end of the socioeconomic distribution, which may indirectly reduce screening disparities. Some of the limitations of this work. So mandates don't limit cost sharing, and that may explain why we're not finding huge effects for other groups. It could be that, fine, you have coverage now, but the cost sharing still makes the service unaffordable. In addition, the BRFAS data in and of themselves, we can't identify who had coverage before the mandate. The mandate laws don't apply to those who had self-insured plans and are exempt under ERISA. We can't identify who's publicly insured. And we also can't identify diagnostic versus preventative screenings. And it's only the preventative screenings that are covered. And in fact, if your screening that you go in for becomes diagnostic during the procedure, the mandate will not apply. So this is where you may have heard the colonoscopy loophole. People get surprise bills as they come out from a colonoscopy because there was actually a polypectomy performed. And finally, we did include some individual risk factors and comorbidities, but it's not a very comprehensive list. So just in closing, some of the relevance to the ACA. Clearly, we've seen a big change in coverage for preventive care screenings, and the ACA does some things that state mandates didn't. It doesn't exempt self-insured plans, and the cost sharing is clear. It's supposed to be first dollar coverage. There were some issues initially with the colonoscopy loophole, but there was actually a directive released, I believe that was 2013, to try and correct this issue so that people won't be seeing those surprise bills. So maybe there's some hope for policy approaches to reducing disparities. But at the end of the day, even if we can fix the issue for screening, as the other presenters mentioned earlier, so now I have my screening covered, but what if my insurance is still terrible and I can't cover the cost of treatment? And with that, we'll go ahead and go to questions. Great.